Hello and welcome to Sowing the Seeds of Change, where we explore the ideas that are forming our future reality. My name is Dr. Roslyn Savage. After an environmental epiphany 20 years ago, I left a corporate career to row solo across three oceans, using my adventures to raise environmental awareness. And ever since then, I've been obsessed with how we create a better world. On this show, I talk with scientists, philosophers, economists, and activists about how we create a thriving world for people and planet.
So that's something that I've tried to practice is noticing whenever there's a polarity and going, is this a really clear black and white distinction or is it actually a spectrum? And what have I got to gain if I go and visit both sides and really empathize and try and understand what they have to offer? And usually there's something good there. You know, usually a lot of times group conflict comes down to an overly simplified polarization. It's like, we want to have no leaders, or this guy over here is the leader. That's the polarization. And actually what you need is something in between those two poles. But you're not going to get there unless the people that are occupying those poles feel like they've genuinely been heard and understood and their perspective is valued. And then suddenly the space opens up for a more subtle kind of harmony.
Richard Bartlett describes himself as one of those people with a lot of websites, and he's right. He's the co-founder of Lumio, a platform for small-scale digital democracy inspired by the 2011 Occupy movement. He's also co-leader of The Hum, a training and consulting company that supports decentralized organizations. And he's also the co-director of the Enspiral Foundation, which is a professional network of friends supporting each other to do more meaningful work in the world. And he's the author of a community-building methodology called Micro-Solidarity. Rich is a fanatical Twitterer and tells me he's a halfway decent blues guitarist. He grew up in a fundamentalist Christian community in New Zealand and now lives literally as far away as you possibly can, in Lucca, Italy, for reasons that become clearer in our conversation. I haven't yet met Rich in person, although I know him from some work he did earlier this year with Seeds, our sponsors, and the complementary currency. I was impressed with Rich's very practical wisdom, so I was inspired by that interaction to take a course with The Hum, hosted by Rich and his partner Natty, and the course was excellent. In this conversation, we talk about complex systems, chaos and coherence, nouns and verbs, cultural inoculation, methodologies rather than mission statements, trust, partnership and domination, Rhianne Eisler and Kim Stanley Robinson, heaven and hell, Christianity, LSD, fear of death, polarization and harmonization. Hi, Richard, and welcome to Sowing the Seeds of Change. It's a real pleasure to be in conversation with you today.
Hi, Roz. Thanks for having me.
So there are so many different ways that we could take this conversation, but let's start off, as I always do, by asking you, please, for your favourite quote and why.
Sure. What comes to mind for me is Ilya Prigogine, he's sort of thought of as like the grandfather of complexity sciences, or one of the grandfathers. And the quote, as it's translated, is, when a complex system is far from equilibrium, small islands of coherence in a sea of chaos have the capacity to shift the entire system to a higher order.
I think you and I probably both know a bit about seas of chaos. But so why does this quote mean so much to you?
I think we live in a sea of chaos. I mean, I think that we create things like civilization and norms and society and things to try and manage the chaos, you know, and by chaos, I mean this kind of infinitely unfolding uncertainty. We just don't know what's coming next. And the huge multiplicity of possibilities that can just keep flourishing in front of us because of just the way that life works. We live in chaos, and a lot of people would prefer not to look at it. You know, we try and make things predictable and safe. And so we have institutions and rules and governance and so on to try and make things predictable. And it seems like, at least I don't know if this is just a meme, if people are just saying it, or if it actually is true that human society is getting more complex. And part of that increasing complexity means increasing chaos. You know, it means, it feels like if I look into what's coming in the future, it feels like all of the probabilities for all of the possibilities are all just increasing. You know, we might become a multiplanetary species, as Elon Musk wants us to be. We might completely lose civilization due to a collapse of our biosphere because of what we're doing to the climate and the pollution that we're putting into the environment. Both of those possibilities feel to me quite realistic over the next, I don't know, 100 years, 200 years. So there's this escalating complexity and uncertainty and chaos. And that can be a reason for fear. You know, a lot of people would prefer not to look at that because it's really uncomfortable, because a lot of those outcomes are really unpleasant. And so then it's like, well, how do we navigate in a storm, right? I love the quote because he just says, focus on the small island of coherence. If I'm in a small island of coherence, maybe, well, at least for me, the island of coherence, as it applies to me, you know, he's talking about physics and these kind of complex systems. For me, the island of coherence is a small group of mutual aid and shared understanding and trust and care. If I'm in that little island, at very least, I'm going to be taken care of. And at best, there's the possibility that we have the capacity to shift the entire system. You know, that when dramatic disruption comes our way, people are always looking for, where's the coherence? Who's got a confident, straightforward story that I can follow? And so I want to live my life in that story.
It reminds me of one of my favorite quotes, which is Margaret Mead, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful individuals can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. Although it can feel quite challenging at times trying to create coherence, even in a small group of thoughtful individuals, trying to create that island of coherence. And I know this is something that you've spent the last like decade plus really focusing your attention on. So what, in your experience, has been the most effective way to create that coherence and that alignment in groups?
It's such a big question, eh? I think of it as essentially a question of culture. Culture, I mean social norms, beliefs, habits, rituals, expectations, language, you know, all of this quite subtle, somewhat abstract, the ways that we interact with each other, the ways that we encounter each other, our protocols of interaction. A lot of it comes down to that. And then, so then the question is like, where does culture come from? Or how do you engineer culture? I actually asked that question in a workshop once in Portland, Oregon, where does culture come from? Thinking it was a rhetorical question. And someone, maybe because it was Portland, Oregon, said fermentation. And I loved that answer, fermentation. Like as in, if you are making like a loaf of sourdough bread or you're making yogurt, you know, you start with the mother culture and then it goes through a process of fermentation. So if it was making a loaf of bread, you have a really intensely inoculated piece of dough, and then you mix that in with some new ingredients and you put it in a warm, dark place for a few hours. And then, you know, then it rises, the culture spreads through the whole loaf. I really think that's a useful metaphor for how do you spread culture in a group. It's like, you need a mother. there needs to be a source. It needs to come from somewhere. And I don't think it comes from nowhere. You know, I think life begets life. We need to be drawing from somewhere. So I've had this extraordinary privilege to have encountered some of these mother cultures in my life, you know, to be in touch with the genealogy where it does feel like there are groups with a high degree of coherence. And when I say you have this mother culture and then you incubate it or you ferment it overnight in a dark place, that process, as it applies to human groups, I think is about spending time together, building trust, building a sense of collective identity and who are we and what do we care about? What do we believe in? What's in and what's out? That whole process seems to be crucial to me to incubate that culture, to give it a place where it can grow. Because there is a, you know, we all live in wider cultures. We inherit a whole bunch of assumptions and beliefs from our parents and from the media that we watch and from the school that we went to, and all these kind of external sources are feeding us. And most of those sources are not coherent, you know, mostly, or if they are coherent, it's coherence that's come at the expense of freedom. So like you think about school or the workplace, most people are experiencing that in a very top down command and control. Like we just have to kind of crush people's freedom so that we can get them all aligned. And that's a kind of coherence, but it's not a coherence that I'm particularly interested in. I don't think it's the kind of group that you're interested in either. We're looking for something that's more dignified, you know, that's more creative, that's more alive, that's more accessible and inclusive, and that people can bring their gifts and respond to each other. I think each of us do have particular qualities, strengths and weaknesses. And that there's a way to design a group that calls each person's strengths forward, and we can sort of reinforce what's best in each other and create something that's better than any individual. That's kind of the aspiration.
Absolutely, yeah. So that the whole becomes greater than the sum of the parts. And this is something, a question that's very present for me at the moment, about how you allow for that individual sovereignty for each person to really bring their gifts and their talents and to somehow align their individual purpose with the collective purpose. And I quite like the image of a flock of birds, a murmuration of starlings or whatever, that are governed by these three rules of separation so they don't bump into each other, coherence so they stay close enough together, and alignment in terms of their shared vision of why they're together in a flock rather than just being a widely dispersed species. So birds seem to be quite good at doing this. Human beings maybe less naturally so. There was an interview with you that I was listening to that might relate to this, where you said that we need more agreement on methodology and process than on ideology. And I wonder if that's kind of what the starlings are doing. They have these three simple rules. They're not arguing between themselves about what it means to be a flock of starlings. But it was also sort of surprising to me, because my assumption would have been that having a shared ideology would be the most powerful possible unifying factor, rather than what sounds relatively mundane of this sort of procedural stuff. So I wonder if you can unpack that for me a bit more.
Well, first to say, I might be wrong, but it's definitely a very strongly held opinion, which has guided me well so far. It's really common, your perspective, it's really common. People think you should get alignment on the abstract. You know, what's the purpose? What's the mission? What are our values? That's kind of a normal approach to designing an organization. It's just not my approach. I kind of devalue the nouns and I value the verbs. It's what are we doing? And you notice in that example of the starlings, all of those rules are not about individual sovereign birds. The rules are all about the interactions between the birds. Mm. And you'll notice I don't usually use the word sovereignty, because sovereign to me implies a disconnected individual with a impermeable boundary. And I don't really think of individuals in that way. You know, obviously we have, it's really important that we can have a sense of autonomy, of agency, of personal responsibility and so on. All of that, no doubt about that. And we are so impacted by the people that we are with, you know, that it seems to me more useful to talk about what are the rules for our encounter? How are we going to interact with each other? As my partner, Nati, always says, how do we want to be together? And articulate that. What kind of interactions are we up for? That sets the scene for the emergence. So those starlings, they've got these very simple rules, and then this higher order of complexity and creativity and kind of beauty and wonder that you see in this murmuration of starlings, that's emerging from the right set of simple rules. I think the same thing can happen with human groups, that you have a simple set of rules for the encounter. You don't have to spend a lot of time talking about, well, I don't have to spend a lot of time talking about the purpose or the values or getting an agreement on this very abstract layer. It's more about what's the qualities of the encounter? How do we want to feel when we're working together? What kind of dynamics do we want to experience between us? And if we focus on that, it's worked for us so far. I don't know if it's just limited to me or we're still, you know, in the R&D process, but it seems to focus people on the right part of the problem. Like, it's so attractive to talk about abstractions. It's so attractive to talk about, like, what's wrong with capitalism, or what about patriarchy? And like, we need to have theory. We need to step into that big picture space to get some understanding of what's going on in the world. But there's not much that I can do about patriarchy. You know, I can do something about how specific behaviors show up in a patriarchal context. I can do something about how do I share the microphone with women, for example. That's like a very specific verb where we can look at something concrete and say, hey, in this group, we want to have equal speaking time. Okay, well, that says something that I can do something about. If the agreement is we're going to dismantle patriarchy, well, how do I know when I've succeeded? Like, it doesn't seem likely that we're going to achieve that anytime soon. And okay, maybe patriarchy is an extreme example where we're talking about all of the last 5,000 years of human history. we maybe zoom in a little bit closer, and it's like, we're, you know, this organization's mission is to create a thriving life for all, or, you know, people always come up with these very lovely vision statements, but they're often quite distant from the verbs, from the practical, what am I supposed to do today, and how are we going to measure our progress next week?
I find that really helpful. Yeah, that emphasis on the verbs, the being-ing, a way of taking what can otherwise rapidly devolve into a lot of differences of ideological opinions and find a way forward. And I think this is something else that you said, the belonging without the conformity. So there is this sense of that synergistic whole without people having to agree on everything all of the time, which is just never going to happen, basically.
Well, I believe that actually agreement doesn't have much to do with nouns again. I think, like, it's really easy to look at a proposal and people disagree with this or that idea. Like, we do that. That's just a natural way that a lot of groups work. But actually, I don't think agreement is about everyone saying, yes, I have the same words to describe my reality as you do. I think agreement is operating at a lower level down the biological stack. It's something that happens in our body when we feel trust, you know, when we feel we've been heard, when we feel that our position is respected. And when we have that sense of trust with the other person, then we're willing to kind of go along with what's happening. And when that trust is insufficient, then every possible opportunity for debate, we're going to take it and say, I don't agree with this, I don't agree with that, I don't agree with that. And it can be very attractive to try and just keep talking about the ideas all the time. But actually what's happening is we've crossed some kind of threshold where there's not enough embodied trust. People don't feel sufficiently safe or at ease with each other. And so we need to be working at that level.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Something that has been a bit of a challenge for a lot of groups during these strange times of COVID, especially groups that weren't in existence before the pandemic, has been how to have that quality time together to build those relationships of trust, when really the only time that we tend to see each other is when we come together for calls for like a specific purpose, where we don't have that time to hang out by the water cooler or go to the pub after work and really build that relationship in an informal way. And I know that there are various ways to do this and to encourage one-to-one conversations and that building of relationship there. But I wonder if you've got any other pointers about how to create that really rich web of connection between colleagues who interact mostly through Zoom or through asynchronous messaging tools?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. It's something that I've been thinking about a lot. And we were just talking about this yesterday at work, because it's not just you, right? There's a lot of people experiencing this at the moment. I think perhaps people have taken for granted how much utility there is in the water cooler conversation and the occasional pub after work conversation. That it's working at that, yeah, the level I was talking about, the embodied trust thing of, you know, if you have a meal with someone, again, as a mammal, as an animal, as you take time to eat food together, that immediately escalates the trust between people. But it's not just the trust factor. It's not just the feeling of connection. It's also a very practical informational thing happening there, that stories get shared. What are you up to right now? Or the sort of, you know, the new ideas, the random creative spark of brilliance that happened, that gets shared in informal spaces quite a lot of the time. And so without those informal, you know, we call them bumping spaces, the sort of unstructured, occasionally people just bump into each other. And without that, then an organization is really losing a lot, both in terms of its, maybe in terms of its brain and its heart. You know, there's it's lacking information and it's also lacking connection and care. And so some people are noticing this and saying, okay, we've got to replace it. But have you ever tried having a beer over Zoom? You know, like maybe with your best friend or something, it could work. But for most people, that's just awkward. It doesn't really fulfill. I actually did that over on New Year's. We had a New Year's party with me and my partner here in Italy and a friend of ours in Sweden. And it was horrible. It was just not a good party. It was just disappointing. You know, we're trying to socialize, but what we need is to eat a meal together and then go dancing. And we can't do that over Zoom in any kind of satisfying way. And so I think we need to adapt to the new context that we're in and not just try to reproduce the old thing. You know, it's like when they when radio first came out, and they were just run old theater plays on the radio, and it took a while to understand you can do other things, you know, it's a different format. So what we've had the most success with in the organizations that we support is, yes, there's something social and it's informal, but it still has structure. It seems like structure helps. So, like, for example, some of the groups we work with, they really have put this emphasis on care and development. And for me, those two words are kind of on a spectrum. So care being a space in a small group where you can just go and share your emotional reality with someone and feel like you're going to be heard, and you'll get advice if you want it, but mostly you just get heard. And that's a kind of like stress release or an opportunity to connect and feel like you matter. And then that's kind of like almost like patching up for harm that's been done or bruises that you've been carrying. And then the more positive aspiration is development. That's like, okay, what are the parts of myself that I want to develop? What aspirations do I have? What skills do I want to get better at? And can I get support from a few peers to make some headway on those goals? And so we've been designing these groups and saying, well, first of all, because we're all working online, we need to replace something about that, those informal spaces that create social fabric. We need to attend to that. We need to account for that in our project management system. You know, we can't spend 100% of our capacity just on delivering tasks. We have to leave some of our capacity for connecting with each other, for developing trust, for weaving social fabric. And then, yeah, what are some things that people are interested in doing together that would have the byproduct of creating more trust? And for me, that's, yeah, care and development. And we're collecting a lot of practices and so on around creating these structures for people so they can easily step in. At the moment, probably the most exciting group I'm working with is a couple of networks inside of the UN, where, again, they're trying to create a more equitable and more trusting set of relationships within a very hierarchical bureaucratic organization. And so we're resourcing them with, here's a bunch of practices, here's some run sheets, so that as someone who doesn't have a lot of experience, you can pick this up and self-organize with a group of four people and just run through the steps and say, this is the question for today, have a conversation about it. And there's a sequence that people are going down.
So my mischievous thoughts about that would be, if they're using those social technologies between the staff of the UN, wouldn't it be really cool if they could maybe also cultivate them between the national heads of state who show up to the actual UN meetings? I mean, what a very different kind of gathering that could start to look like.
This is the fermentation question again, I think. So we're currently fermenting a particular kind of culture within these voluntary employee networks. There's a couple of them. And our aspiration is that's going to affect the rest of the organization and eventually the leadership. And then eventually, yeah, wouldn't it be wonderful if the leadership would affect the leaders of countries, and that some of this culture of respect and vulnerability and authenticity could leak out a little?
Gosh, wow, wouldn't that be nice? And I'm going to come back to something along those political lines when we come back after the break. Sowing the Seeds of Change is brought to you through the generous support of Seeds, now growing together in a bioregion near you. Seeds is an experimental global collaborative community, learning how to collectively govern and regenerate our one home, this earth, one village at a time. Learn more at joinseeds.earth. Welcome back to my conversation with Richard Bartlett, an expert in decentralized organizations, co-founder of Lumio, The Hum, the Inspiral Foundation, and Micro Solidarity. Richard, I would like to ask you one of the questions that I ask all of my guests. If you were the democratically elected king or queen, if you prefer, of the world for a day, what would your first decree be and why?
This is such a difficult question for me. As a closeted anarchist, it's very hard for me to imagine being in charge of the world. So I think I would have to, the decree would have to be something about decentralizing my own power, or at very least encouraging people to take hold of their own power. So there might be something about, you know, people must start organizing in small groups to have this experience of democracy at the small scale and to feel for themselves the power and the trade-offs and the challenges and the joys of working with a collaborative group of people with democratic principles. I think it would be good if everyone had that particular kind of civics education. And maybe if people had enough of that education, then they'd be ready to get rid of me as the king.
Okay, so your first decree would be to basically make yourself redundant at some point.
I'm quite lazy.
That is a great answer. Before I move on from that, could you just say a little bit more when you say that you're a closet anarchist? I'm not sure you're actually that much in the closet, but what does anarchy mean to you? Because it clearly means, to a lot of people, it means something quite negative and scary.
Yeah, closet maybe is not the right word, but what I mean is I'm not an anarchist in the sense of having a tribal identity like a leftist or a feminist might be an identity that comes with both a set of values and a sense of who's in and who's out. I'm an anarchist in the sense that I'm trying to practice anarchism as I understand it, which means the part that I'm focused on, and I'm always going to have a limited interpretation, but the part that makes sense to me is we always have an opportunity when we encounter another person to set that relationship more in the direction of partnership. Partnership being, we're different. You know, at the moment, you're the host and I'm the guest. We've got different roles, but there's some kind of mutual respect going on there. There's some kind of dignity in this relationship. I've got the option to go towards partnership or towards domination. And the domination is always a dyad where you've got this awful duet between domination and submission, where one person is overexerting and the other person is shrinking. And that domination-submission relationship, that's part of my inheritance as a human being. You know, that's something that it might be somewhere in our biology. It's definitely in our cultural inheritance. And I've always got opportunities to choose over and over again. Am I going to play this one more like a partnership or more like a dictatorship? And so my anarchism is about noticing where these opportunities for coercion and oppression and seeking ways to flip them into liberation, freedom, passion, exchange, you know, coming out of this extraction thing and into this abundance thing.
Yeah, that language around domination versus partnership, I know you and I have both been very influenced by Rhianna Eisler's work, which is so articulate on this. But how can that change happen when it feels like so many people have been so indoctrinated, enculturated, almost brainwashed into this dynamic that when there is that freedom, it becomes almost like agoraphobic for some people, where there's too much choice, too much autonomy. How to really present the benefits of that? Because I think you and I hope I'm making a correct assumption here, but please correct me if I'm not, that we feel that it's going to take all of us on board if human beings are going to get through this next phase of our evolution.
I'm not sure. I think that's part of why I brought this quote from Ilya Prigogine about the small islands of coherence. Focusing on the small, I don't make any claims about the large scale. I try to avoid it anyway. Like, I'm not trying to enroll millions of people into a project. My scale kind of tops out around 20,000 people, 30,000 people, because my view of the world is not linear. I don't believe that any of us are going to come up with a program that's good enough to enroll everyone into. I think we've got to rely on the emergence. We've got to rely on all of these different coalitions and factions pulling in different directions, sometimes reinforcing each other, sometimes undermining each other, and that the dynamic tension between all those things producing something that continues to affirm and spread life. And that's the game that I'm playing. It's not about trying to come up with the one true plan that everyone can agree with.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that. A while ago, I was looking at the work of Lynn McTaggart and some of her colleagues around the intention experiment. And there is a theory that for change to happen at that sort of energetic intentional level, you just need the square root of 1% of the population that's looking to change to really be holding that coherent intention. And on the day that I read that, I worked out from that day's latest figures on the population of the world, So what would the square root of 1% of 7.8 billion or whatever be? And it came out at the surprisingly small number of 8,888, which was conveniently easy to remember, and also really encouraging in terms of not needing 7.8 billion people to be in agreement, which... as we see how hard it is trying to get three or four people in agreement, like that's not going to happen. So I actually found that quite encouraging, and it would seem that focusing on the small and what we can do is actually surprisingly powerful in terms of creating change.
I mentioned the UN. They're a good example where we've got, I think there's about 20,000 people working at the UN. I'm not exactly sure of that. And that's where we've taken, you know, almost all of the countries in the world have set aside some of their budget and they've sent some of their best people together and said, go and work on global challenges. And, you know, a lot of us are somewhat disappointed with the outcome, but at least inspired by the intention. Imagine if instead of a great big bureaucracy of 20 or 30,000 people, we just had that many people, but split into many small groups that had that resourcing and legitimacy, but weren't encumbered by the bureaucracy. You know, like say a company like WhatsApp, for instance, that was just a couple of people before it got acquired by Facebook. You know, they had affected billions of people's lives, and it was just a tiny group of people, enough to fit in one dinner table, that built that thing. And that's a pretty common story in the world of startups these days and technology, that a really small group of people can be extremely efficient and impactful. Well, let's just imagine that we, instead of having one big behemoth, we just had, you know, 200 groups of 200 people all organized in these very innovative, like I say, well-funded and legitimate organizations working on global problems. I feel like we'd put a more substantial dent than the current way that we're doing things.
It's interesting that you choose WhatsApp as an example there, because there was, as far as I know, no particular ideology associated with WhatsApp. It's not like they had a particular view of how the world should be. They were just trying to facilitate people connecting with each other. So does that connect back to what we were talking about with the methods and the processes rather than the shared vision?
Yeah, sure. I hadn't thought about it that way, but I've chosen to work in the market primarily rather than in the state or in the civil sector, partly because the market, most of it, not all of it, but mostly it kind of demands you to do practical stuff. You know, yeah. It's like you succeed or fail based on how well you meet people's needs. And I'm not here to advocate like we should turn the UN into a market-driven enterprise, no, but to say that there's something really valid in that very rigorous mechanism for choosing, you know, is this successful? Does it deserve to continue? And big institutions and bureaucracies create all kinds of immunity against those tests, and they can just continue blundering along, telling nice stories and spending a lot of money on management consultants without necessarily having any constructive impact. So I would take that as inspiration, not as a prescription, oh, we should put everything in the market. But yeah, can we have, you know, concrete tests, logical pass or fail, true or false tests that say, is this valuable? Is this making a contribution that we care about? So many organizations are immunized against that test.
So going back to some of our mutual influences, I know you and I are both fans of Kim Stanley Robinson, and there is a slight risk that this podcast is turning into the Kim Stanley Robinson Appreciation Society, because the other day I was talking with Bill McKibben, who is also quite a fan. And on the one hand, I feel really inspired by many of Stan's books, where he's looking at the future and the potential there, all of the possibilities open to us. But on the other hand, I love it how human all of his characters are, with all of the cognitive fallacies that we have at the moment. In his vision of the future, we still have those several hundred years down the line. And his humans are still very, very human. You know, we send a bunch of people off to colonize Mars, and by lunchtime on day two, they're all disagreeing about to what extent they should terraform the red planet. So I'd love to know, like, what you take away from his work. Does it make you feel more hopeful, less hopeful? What is it that attracts you to his writing?
He came to mind recently because I just read Ministry for the Future. And that's such a compelling novel for me, because it draws, to me, what looks like a realistic path beyond climate change being an existential threat. You know, there's a kind of, we solved it, sort of. And it's credible to me because it's like I was saying before, it's non-linear. It's not like they came up with the one good plan and everyone got on board and then we licked it, you know. There's all these different actors pulling in different directions with different incentives and different value systems, and some of them are in conflict with each other. That seems to me what's likely to happen. You know, in the story, there's one group, for instance, who are eco-terrorists, and they just stopped the airline industry by blowing up a lot of airliners. Like, I don't think we should do that. That doesn't reflect my values at all. But I can imagine that such a group might exist in the future, and then they might, on balance, have a positive impact, as horrifying as that might sound. Like, that seems to me what a realistic, that's what history looks like. You know, these we blunder along. there's the goodies and the baddies, but it's never actually as simple as that. We're pulling in lots of different directions, and somehow life keeps on lifing. I think that's what inspires me about his stories, is that there's this real pragmatic realism, despite being so imaginative. A lot of it is really realistic. It's well researched. It reflects how I see the world today.
So it would be a good idea then to give up on the aspiration that the humans of the future are going to be any more organized or any smarter or any more coherent than we are now, to maybe just really accept our humanness as being the way that it's likely to remain, that we will continue to blunder along, but we may yet manage to blunder into a viable future in some way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. I have definitely been flirting with the idea recently that we might be getting better as a species in some way. I'm just allowing this possibility that there's a thing called progress. It doesn't come naturally to me, but it's been nice to flirt with this concept that maybe we are going somewhere. And, you know, just the quality of life for the average person, I think it's been going up for a while. And I know that there's lots of reasons to be fearful of the future, but we've got to be careful when we make claims about the future that we are actually treating reality as it is, and not just getting distracted by our own lenses. You know, we're you and I, and probably many people in the audience, grew up with a Christian grammar. And we maybe didn't go to church, but we've still got the Christian grammar and this idea of heaven and hell and of the afterlife and this kind of threshold where either everything goes incredibly well or it goes incredibly badly. You know, either we have annihilation or we have bliss. That's really deeply imprinted in us. And it's not just because of the Bible. I think the Bible is actually responding to something that's in us, you know, the tendencies that are within us. I think we have this interaction. And lately I've just been, noticing that tendency in myself and kind of letting go of these massive stories about how we're either going to have a utopia or a dystopia. That's always the way that my mind goes. And I'm just trying to release that a little bit and assume that the future is unpredictable. There's some terrifying possibilities. There's some inspiring possibilities. And whatever I guess, it's probably not going to be that. You know, that's the thing that we can count on. It's not going to go the way that I imagine it's going to go. I didn't predict a pandemic. And a pandemic is an incredibly predictable thing to have happened. Never crossed my mind until it happened.
This is true. What you were saying just then reminds me of a couple of the things that I really appreciate about you. One of them is your ability to seemingly step away from the lenses that most people bring to reality and to actually see in a very clear-sighted way, which connects with your ability to run thought experiments and go, what if I look at things this way? Or what if this is true? Or what if this isn't true? That really lateral thinking of possibility and your ability to see options and capacities and eventualities that most people don't see from sort of being on the tracks. This may be an impossible question to answer, but I'm wondering how you manage to take away some of those filters and lenses that so many of us feel attached to.
I have at least three answers. I'm really glad you asked. It's actually very kind of you to say it. I feel seen. That's something I try to contribute to the world. One, the source of it, as far as I know, is that I was raised within a fundamentalist Christian community. And in my early 20s, I was excommunicated as an apostate. And that means that, you know, I was given the boot. And that was because of this process of thinking. I literally had a day where I said to myself, imagine if this is not true. Imagine if everything that you've been taught by your family and your school and your entire community is just a story that got out of hand. You know, it's just a myth that someone misinterpreted as a fact. Imagine if God is not actually this, you know, kind of personal human-like creature who has a personal interest in my life. Imagine that is not true. How would life be different? And once I allowed myself to fully occupy that imaginary space, my faith completely evaporated. Because life didn't look any different at all. It's like, oh, okay. So now I'm a, like, you know, material humanist or something. I don't know. that somehow stepping through the veil or coming out the other side of a totalizing belief system. And it was, I'm making a long story short, but I came out okay on the other side.
You weren't struck dead by a thunderbolt from the blue for your heretical thoughts. Yeah.
No, I'm officially a heretic, but nothing bad has happened. Only good things so far. That definitely has equipped me. So that's the first thing, is noticing that the consensus around me is not the only possibility, and then really occupying that imaginary space of like, what if they were wrong? The second one is taking psychedelics. And those two things kind of coincide. It's like shortly after I left the church, I just had a like sex, drugs, and rock and roll phase. And yeah, a lot of things changed about my way of seeing the world after I took a lot of LSD. You know, it's as if many of the abstractions dissolved in a way, and I got to reconstruct them a bit more intentionally. And yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily recommend everyone takes a lot of LSD, but it certainly was a significant catalyst in my way of thinking. Maybe a safer alternative, is the third answer that came to mind, was the way that I use social media. So I've been really intentional in the last couple of years to assume that I'm a social creature. You know, I'm social before I'm rational. My embodied instincts are social, and it's only this rationality kind of comes in as an optional upgrade to sociability. And so because of that dynamic, I'm a tribal creature. In a fundamental way, I'm more interested in belonging than I am in facts. And I think that if you take that view on social media, you'll see that everyone is mostly just patrolling the boundaries of their tribe and pretending to have an argument about facts. We're pretending to talk about the vaccine or the latest political scandal. But really what we're doing is just saying, are you in or are you out? Are you on team red or team blue? Are you on my team or not? Are you us or are you them? And a lot of the emotional intensity that you always see on social media is because people's sense of collective identity is being threatened. You know, it's like you've insulted the queen or the chief or my mother, or that's what's going on for people, is because their belonging is at stake. And so I've had that lens for the last few years, just assume that basically that sort of micro nationalistic sort of tribalism thing is what is motivating most people's participation in social media. And if that's true, then to intentionally seek out many tribes and to always notice, which tribe am I in? And I actually, every time I say the word tribe, I have this little cringe of like, I'm not talking about historical indigenous tribes who know how to function with coherence. I'm talking about this kind of tribal word that we mean a very simplistic and naive and kind of violent. You know, that's the kind of tribe that I'm thinking of.
More like the school ground in-group and out-group.
Exactly. I mean, maybe that's a more useful phrase, is just thinking in terms of in-groups and out-groups and making sure that I'm connected to lots of different in-groups. And I'm attempting to, assume that they're not all idiots, assume that they're not all wrong, and try and sift through and find what's the gem, you know, what's the little piece of truth in this person's perspective. And yeah, that's kept me nimble. I think that's kept me really flexible in my thinking, because there's always a little glimmer of truth. I think Ken Wilber said, you know, no one's smart enough to be 100% wrong.
I haven't heard that before. I like that. Yeah, because there is that risk that when we disagree with somebody, first of all, we think, oh, well, clearly they don't know the facts. So if I tell them the facts, then they'll see things my way. Then if we tell them the facts and we still disagree, we go, oh, well, they must be stupid. They haven't understood what I just told them. And then we find out, actually, you know, they've got a PhD, which, of course, is not exclusive of being stupid. But for whatever, you know, we find out they're not stupid. So we go, oh, well, they must be evil in that case. If they've heard my facts and they've understood my facts and they still disagree with me, they must be evil. And it is, I suppose, finding that open-heartedness and that empathy to go, oh, well, they just have a different lens on than I do. And maybe if I'd have grown up in their situation, maybe I would have that lens too. So it takes the sting out of the judgment. So it sounds like sort of at the core of your ability to see things more clearly is that that willingness to contradict yourself, to go to see the stories that you've been telling yourself about something and to notice that they're stories. They're not reality. They're not hard facts. It's a story. It's cultural framing. It's something like that. And to go, what if that weren't true? Is that a fair representation?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. It takes a kind of courage or a kind of faith that I will be okay, even if some of my core beliefs change in the process.
Yeah, that you'll still be you.
Yeah, that I might, something important might change, but I'm not going to die. And I think it is the fear of death that keeps people from changing their mind a lot of time. If you're so attached to if your identity is so strongly fused to your ideas, of course you're not going to change your ideas because it feels like dying.
Yes, it's something that I've been thinking about recently, wanting my own personal upgrade. So I suppose my first upgrade was over 20 years ago now, where I noticed that the story that money was going to buy me happiness wasn't working for me. And my first clue was that I had all the things that were meant to make me happy and I was really miserable. So it's like, okay, that story clearly not working. And I'm at a stage now where I feel like I have a new set of stories and they've been serving me quite well for quite some time now. But I'm also recognising that they're holding me back from taking the next step in my evolution. And even though I feel like I've learned a lot about fear and how to cope with it, I'm noticing that I'm kind of attached to some of these stories, that I associate them with this happier self that I've been for 20 years or so now. And that sense of loss or of death in letting them go, I can feel my ego's going, no, let's hang on to those stories. And I guess maybe this is where the psychedelics can come in like getting you off that particular tram track. You know, it throws the switches and puts you onto a different track and just loosens up a bit of that mental rigidity that can develop over time.
Certainly. It's also it's a bit like rolling the dice. I think it's good for a lot of people to take a risk now and then, but it's also, I wouldn't be comfortable sort of prescribing it to everyone. What I feel more comfortable as a general prescription is about looking to, you know, who do you surround yourself with? Who's in your company? You know, who do you look up to? Things are a lot less scary when you've seen someone else do them. Someone that you know and trust, you know, and I think most of us, when we go looking for it, we can actually identify inspiring characters that have a trajectory in life that we want to emulate. And that makes it so much more accessible than having to like fearlessly go on your own.
Yes, even if not many people have trodden that path before, just knowing that somebody has done it and survived is probably quite deeply rooted in our lizard brains that if we see someone else jump off that big cliff into that pool and they bob up to the surface and they're still alive, then the rest of us are quite happy to jump in as well. So this feels like a good moment to go to another one of my standard questions. Rich, in these slightly unusual times when we're having this conversation, maybe there's something that you haven't really done before. What's the last time that you did something for the first time and what was it?
This is a strangely difficult question for me because despite talking about my, you know, mental flexibility and courage and so on, I get a lot of sense of security from doing everything the same. Yeah, I'm a very routinized kind of person. I like to have everything exactly the same. And that somehow, you know, enable some kind of freedom. So I don't like doing new things. And this is someone who's migrated countries. I don't know how that happened. But the simple answer, the actual concrete answer of like something that I've done recently for the first time, I found a game that I like. And I've always had issues with, you know, like board games and things. I've always found them really unpleasant for lots of different reasons about the kind of social dynamics that emerge and the awkwardness of competing and who I become when I'm very competitive or who
we could probably have a whole conversation about monopoly then.
Right. Well, someone introduced me to a game called Hanabi, which is a cooperative game. It's really simple. You've got a specific deck of cards and you have to give each other hints. You've got five people and you've got to track everyone's what they know and what they don't know. And it's just been so much. Yeah, I finally found a game where I'm like, I get this. This gives me a lot of joy. I can excel, but not at anyone else's expense. Yeah. So I found a game that I like. That's my big breakthrough. Nice.
How do you spell Hanabi?
Hanabi.
Hadn't heard of that. Interesting.
Yes. Board games were a competitive sport in my family. It could get nasty. Me, my mum, my sister. Yeah.
I'm vicious. I'm a very vicious person when I've got a competitive context.
I find that very hard to imagine. So let's move on to a nice, cheerful subject, like the collapse of civilization. How about that for a nice, light topic?
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah. So with our, we both have a sort of activist background of some sort, and there has often been dramatic rhetoric around these movements, whether they're environmental or social justice or financial. And I believe you've been having a bit of a rethink about whether it's actually helpful to use that apocalyptic language or not. So I wonder if you could share where your thoughts are at the moment on that.
I know for myself, you know, like I have an inner compass that tells me what to do and what not to do. And that's just my own discernment and judgment and, you know, my attempt to live a life of good character. And certainly that compass has been telling me to avoid the apocalyptic language lately. That's not to say that this is a prescription for someone else. You know, I don't have a complaint with Extinction Rebellion. Maybe that's the right, or maybe it was the right thing to get Extinction back onto the, into the newspapers, you know, so that when, you know, in the last couple of months, we had these really serious floods in China, in Germany, in the States, and parts of the UK. And I think the people in the Western world that experienced those floods, the phrase that came to mind was climate emergency. That was an intentional mimetic design from people like Extinction Rebellion and, you know, Fridays for Future and lots of other activists who put that message into our heads. And I think it's the right message to have, that this is a climate emergency. This is not just a bad storm. This is something else. I think that's really effective. The word extinction is kind of like, takes us to a different, it's kind of escalating beyond an emergency, right? It's the word like genocide. You know, it's really, you want to be careful about when that word is used. Mm. Yeah, I've let go of those ways of talking about the future because I think it's at least as likely to shut people down as to wake them up. And I'm not, you know, there are people who really study the science of communication and movement design, and I'm not one of them. As I understand the science, it's like you kind of get one, you can use shock once, you know, so like the anti-smoking or the road safety campaigns, you've kind of got once where you can really just throw a gory image at someone and they're going to go, oh, wow, I should really rethink what I'm doing. But after that, people just desensitize to it. They're like, oh, okay, yeah, it's one of these things where smoking's bad. Look at the package. It's got this gross tumor on it. But that's just what packets of cigarettes look like these days. It doesn't affect me. Mm-hmm. You're much more likely to respond to images of your peers making appeals to your values. That's going to be much more and constructive appeals, you know, like, hey, you and I both value this. And if we take these actions, which are within our scope, we're going to take one step closer to this positive vision. I think that's probably more likely to have a positive outcome in some. And so, yeah, it seems like, you know, Greta Thunberg, for instance, it seems like she's had a very necessary role to play to say the house is on fire and not to say, oh, but it's going to be fine. And we're going to, you know, put out the fire. And she's not saying that. She's just saying the house is on fire. And we've got a vacuum of leadership. It's an emergency. I think that's really necessary. And it's just not the full story. There's got to be something else which says, yeah, what's my piece of the puzzle? What's a constructive change that I can contribute to? And it's got to be credible. You know, like recycling straws, it just doesn't, it's an insult to your intelligence to think that doing a little bit of recycling is going to make a difference to a collapsing biosphere. It's just like, it's not sufficient.
Yeah, that's interesting that you came onto the straws there, because I was going to say, in some ways, it feels like you've been on quite a journey since your days with the Occupy movement, that in a way it's you have transitioned from the really big missions to something that's more subtle, that's more people-based, that's more refined, but not so refined that we're talking about things as small as drinking straws. So I'm just trying to get to where change happens, according to Rich Bartlett's view of the world.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of it just comes down to creating good neighborhoods. And then once you've got a few good neighborhoods, then you need some governance and you need some accountability and you need some systems for legitimacy and robust checks and balances and so on. And in a lot of the world, especially in the West, we just don't have many good neighborhoods left. And so people have been atomized down into this individualistic consumer who's kind of like pushed around by the requirements of their workplace and the demands of the social media algorithms, which are like addicting our brains and just kind of pushing us around like rats in a cage. Yeah. And these atomized individuals are just not, they're not the building blocks of a thriving democratic system. You know, like, I think we need people who are active, that are engaged, that are plugged into a sense of purpose, that have a civic responsibility, you know. And you don't do that on your own. You do that with a family and with a network of families and a neighborhood, you know, whether that's a literal physical neighborhood or a virtual neighborhood, which I'm completely comfortable with as someone who's spent a lot of my life traveling. I think that's completely possible. I'm not saying anyone has to move to a commune or something. I'm just saying that the kind of change that's required, I think a lot of it is about undoing the damage that's been done over the last, well, you know, as Adam Curtis says, the century of the self. It's been a very intentional project to turn us into individuals. And that's just not the full story of what humanity is.
Yes, it seems like you tread this fine line in a very balanced way between recognizing the sort of chaos and anarchy on one side, but also I could see the orderliness and the structuredness on the other side, which is making me think a bit about my current obsession of yin yang balance and these co-creative dynamics, which then took my thoughts to when I was participating in your course with The Hum earlier this year, which was hosted by you and your wonderful and wise partner, Nati, and the way that the two of you really embody that sort of yin and yang complementarity so beautifully. So I wonder if there's something that you'd like to share about this duality, but in the sense of like the beautiful harmony between contrasting poles.
I'm glad you named Nati. She was on my mind when you described, you know, my process of maturing from Occupy to now. I was thinking, yeah, basically I just spent more time listening to Nati. You know, she was already working at that subtle layer, and I just learned to take her more seriously. And that's basically the transition that I've been going through. You know, we say when we describe the complementarity of our relationship, often we'll say that she is show and I'm tell. You know, I've got this gift for articulating complex ideas in simple terms, and she's got the gift of actually embodying it. You know, of actually being that model, that demonstration of this is a way that's available. This is one way that you can be a human, and by living that way, it makes a very compelling argument that it's a good way to live. I think on the general principle of polarity, Yeah, this seems to be another very deep, almost like an instinctive pattern that we fall into. Whenever there's a polarity, it's just very easy to take the black and the white, the up and the down, the left and the right, and put them in opposition to each other, you know, and say, okay, we have to rank these. Which one's the best one? Which one's the right one? Which one's the wrong one? And sometimes it's necessary. Sometimes you need to draw a boundary and say, this is right and this is wrong. But it's not always the right thing to do when a polarity comes along. Sometimes there's a lot of insight to be gained from considering, from really visiting each side of the polarity and really inquiring with open-hearted compassion, what value is there here? What have I got to learn? And usually what you find is there's value on both sides. So like in the political polarity between individualism and collectivism, like in the West, that's such a drama. It's such a, like, we're either going to have a free market or we're going to have the nanny state. You know, we've got this like such a difficult tension, and basically people use that as a core site of their, this kind of tribalism I was talking about. You know, it's like you're either on the good group or the bad group. And when I spent a little bit of time in Taiwan, it felt like they had a really different way of thinking about that polarity. And it didn't, at least the people that I was encountering, they didn't seem to see those things in tension. You know, it was just kind of obviously we're both, we're individuals with autonomy and responsibility and duty. And those duties are to someone else, you know, like we're also in groups and we need to, like, a strong society is composed of strong families. That's obvious. Like anyone can see that. And so we kind of need to be looking at both scales, from the very large to the very small. And there's something to be gained from, there's always something to learn about both ends. So that's something that I've tried to practice, is noticing whenever there's a polarity and going, is this a really clear black and white distinction, or is it actually a spectrum? And what have I got to gain if I go and visit both sides and really empathize and try and understand what they have to offer? And usually there's something good there. You know, usually a lot of times group conflict comes down to an overly simplified polarization. It's like, we want to have no leaders, or this guy over here is the leader. That's the polarization. And actually what you need is something in between those two poles. But you're not going to get there unless the people that are occupying those poles feel like they've genuinely been heard and understood and their perspective is valued. And then suddenly the space opens up for a more subtle kind of harmony.
I love that. Yeah. I mean, if we could just have so much of that in the world, of that recognition that the truth usually lies somewhere in between and or includes both things that we perceive as opposite, but are in fact connected. And to sort of find that space in the middle.
And I wouldn't even say it's not, this is my sort of engineering brain kicking in. It's not just that it's in the middle or it's between these two poles. Often it's orthogonal. It's like in a different plane. Mm. Like the solution we're looking for is just not mapped out by the pole that you've got, that you're looking at the moment. It's over there. It's in the lateral dimension.
Yeah, in my mind's eye, I was sort of seeing the two perceived polarities being the two bottom corners of an equilateral triangle, and the space and the option that includes and transcends both of those polarities sort of being at the apex of that triangle. Thank you for that. So I could talk with you all day, Rich. I really could, but I want to be respectful of your time. So
let's go to turning the tables. Have you got a question for me?
I've got lots of questions for you. If I have to zoom in and just choose one, I'm just curious how do people, when they're awake and paying attention to what's happening in the world, and like, I'm avoiding the apocalyptic language, but it does seem like there's a lot of really important crises that need attention. How do you choose what's your piece to work on?
This is such a great question that I've basically been obsessed with for at least the last 10 years since I finished rowing my last ocean, because it felt that I've been told more than once to like pick one problem and focus on it. But as soon as I try to zero in on one problem,
it's like, well, I can't solve that one on its own because it's connected to this one and this one and this one.
So both of those things were true. I needed to be more focused, and yet I couldn't solve a problem in isolation. And I think that the way that I see it now is that in some ways it's easier to change everything than to try and solve one little bit of it, because our political system, economics, social psychology, like all of this, it's all connected. But of course, I personally can't change all of it. So it partly helps knowing that there are other people around the world, other groups, organisations who are dealing with other parts of the puzzle. It also helps to know that there are particularly powerful acupressure points within the system that punch above their weight in terms of their ability to create change. But really, for me personally, when I was trying to answer this question on a cognitive level, my head exploded. It was just completely unanswerable. And something that has been a big part of my journey over the last 10 years particularly has been trusting my intuition much more about what am I here to do. And I particularly love this quote that I'm just going to try and find now. Howard Thurman said, "Ask what makes you come alive and go do it, because what the world needs is people who've come alive." So I actually came up with a formula this week for how I want to spend my time. Something that is joyful, something that is edifying in that it makes me a better person, or something that gets paid. And preferably, it's all three of those. But it's really important for me to be doing things that feel good and aligned with my purpose. And I suppose now that I am looking back over the last 20 years and joining up the dots with the benefit of hindsight, I can see that the rowing, you know, some people have said, what does rowing across oceans have to do with raising environmental awareness? Like, how is that actually helping anything or anybody? And my honest answer to that is, I don't really know. I just know that I felt called to do that. A really powerful calling. And so I just had to trust that whatever entity, whatever worldview you take on this, whatever entity was doing the calling knew what it was doing. And turns out it did in a way that my cognitive mind couldn't see. So I really am just leaning into that trust of feeling guided, and whether that's my subconscious or my heart or my intuition or God, the universe, spirit, source, whatever you want to call it, just trusting it. And so far seems to be working.
That's so good. Yeah, it is. Of course, that kind of leads to the next question of how does one cultivate this intuition or whatever, this guidance system that you're using? How do you, you know, what kind of doubts do you have? How do you tune the machine, as it were? I don't know how much depth you want to share, but I'm curious to know your way of operating this creature.
Yeah, creature is quite a good word for it. I learn a lot of things by doing them wrong. And those are the lessons that I really, really remember. So there have been times when I've ignored my intuition. Like a trivial example would be earlier this year when I got scammed by some very convincing scammers who called me up. It looked like it was my bank calling. My intuition was screaming at me that there was something a bit weird going on, and I ignored it. And luckily, in the end, I didn't actually lose any money, but I had 6 weeks of some considerable anxiety. So that was a reminder to listen to that voice. And then there's also paying attention to the times when it does work. And my journal, I suppose, is my most consistent practice, trying to get some perspective on the decisions that I've made, how they've turned out, better, worse, or kind of neutral. And I suppose that, like anything or anybody, intuition likes to be listened to. You know, earlier on, you said that you felt seen when I made the observation about your ability to step outside of our cultural frameworks. And so I also show my intuition lots of gratitude when it like comes up with the goods. And I feel like if I just keep really appreciating it, it'll keep showing up for me. So I think that was a really lovely question. I hadn't really articulated that or even particularly thought about it before, but yeah, I pay attention to it, and then I show it gratitude for what it's contributed to my life and to my sense of clarity.
That's so good. You've got a different way of describing it than I would, but it matches so close to my experience as well. I think it's like a really good friend, and it took me a while to learn to really listen to what they had to say. But when I do, I get the results.
Yeah, well, I suppose the society, like you in New Zealand, me in Britain, certainly I wasn't brought up to even talk about intuition. I can't remember what age I was when I first came across the word, but it certainly wasn't as a child. And also, like you, I grew up in a religious background, not as dogmatic or as strict as yours sounds, but both of my parents were preachers. And so religion was very much part of my life growing up. So in a way, that guidance had been outsourced to this sort of disembodied abstract God up in his clouds. And I didn't realise for a long time that it was something inside me that was accessible at any time. I kept praying to something outside of me who I never heard from. And so I sort of threw the baby out with the bathwater and gave up on any form of religion, spirituality for quite some time. And then came back to it in a very different way and from a very different direction, and in a way that felt much more empowering to me personally.
That sounds like an upgrade.
Well, there you go. You've upgraded your voice and I've upgraded my intuition. Richard, thank you so much. I really, really appreciate your wisdom, your articulacy, your willingness to share the benefits of all of your learnings along the way. And just thank you for being you, and keep up the amazing work.
Thanks so much, Roz. It's the funnest thing is for me to get to share when I've got a microphone and plenty of time to just tell you what's been going on in my head. So I'm really grateful to have been invited.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation. What I took away from it was a greater understanding of, understanding. In our world, it often feels like many people are talking and not so many are listening, which makes it very hard for us to understand each other. When we really listen, it becomes easier to focus on our similarities rather than our differences, and to tune into the many shades of grey between the black and white extremes of what's very often a polarised discourse. I love the work that Rich is doing. It makes me feel hopeful.